known to many of the world's finest minds that there are many flammable objects hindering the advancement of human progress. Ever since the cavemen learned how to spark fire within the dampness of their dour caves, fire has remained an imposing threat on a literal and figurative basis. This has not prevented authors from writing important novels on the subject of flammability, nor has it curtailed the numerous people who accidentally set themselves on fire for the unintentional amusement of so-called friends. And I speak on this subject from the bowels of crippling trauma and sad personal experience. We thus approach the subject delicately, but passionately, in the conversation that ensues.
Oh God, my arm's on fire! Somebody call 911!
Okay, so I am here with Porchista Kapoor, who is the author of Suns and Other Flammable Objects, and I also understand that you're a professional doodler as well.
Yeah, I like to doodle during my interviews. I'm a nervous interview a little bit, and doodling helps me think, I think.
Okay, well, how are you doing?
I'm good.
Okay, fantastic. I wanted to ask, first of all, about something that is rather obvious in the text, and that is your concern for dialogue and consciousness expressed in variegated forms. You have many italicized asides that reflect thoughts, often the expressions on a character's face, and sometimes the dialogue itself becomes more theatrical. You have call-ins, names, lines, and it becomes almost like, oh, am I reading Harold Pinter or am I reading Porchista? I'm wondering if you set any specific ground rules for how the characters said what they had to say. Do you have an aversion or distrust of the quotation mark? What happened here?
I think it's because the way I write lines, I actually act it out. I'm very... And it's funny, I don't have a big thes background. I guess I was in high school theater, but it's hardly anything. But I really read. Dialogue's really important for me. It doesn't come naturally for me, so I end up reading it out loud, very loudly, in my writing room. And at some point, I was being so theatrical and acting them out so much, like putting on an Iranian accent at times and doing it, that I just, at some point, you know, I have a lot of fun while I'm writing too, and I thought, what if I just put this in play dialogue format, or, you know, so I just started doing that for certain passages, and for a lot of the novel too, I've been really interested in experimenting with like different formats and different ways of getting at the same thing, because I think there's also a lot of repetition of both themes and scenarios in the novel, so I wanted to get at them from like almost every possible angle in a way. Mm. That helps to do that.
Interesting.
Somehow.
Do you find dialogue to be better at acting out? Because I did read another interview that you had conducted, and you had said that you were rather surprised that the lengthy clause-written sentences that you write are difficult to read. You didn't read any of these out at all? Or
I did read them out, but then somehow through the editing phase, they would just get longer and longer. I think I'm very neurotic, so every time I'd have a sentence, I would have to expand it by like three or four times to, again, make room for the, you know, I was always anticipating how people would read these things. I mean, the novel is clearly me being neurotic and on a sentence level many times, but all the sentences just kept getting longer. I'm always shocked at how difficult it is to read. I think it's less the dialogue sections, though. I think some of the more exposition sections, those are the hardest for me to read. Even last night, I stumbled so many times reading my own writing. It almost feels like I'm like one of those fake writers. Like I didn't write this. I'm just an actress reading somebody else's novel. So
you actually added like say 10,000 words just in the editing process?
Yeah, I did.
Really?
Every time I edit, everything. I have, you know, even with my journalism, they'll tell me, okay, cut this piece down and we'll get to the editing phase.
Yeah.
And I always end up adding, even when they tell me specifically cut it down. I don't know what it is. Editing to me just means adding instead of cutting. It's crazy.
Is it possible that perhaps you're getting questions from an editor and that this influx of information causes you to think more and therefore causes any kind of piece or novel or whatever you write to expand and protract in the life?
Yeah, probably, I think. I mean, the minute... I always think of my audience, and that person that I think of as my audience is very quiet and sits with a folded hands and is very polite and
folded
approving.
Hands. Yes. I didn't have my hands folded when I read this. I want to assure you.
It's a good somber schoolgirl.
Wow. I didn't realize this.
And very approving.
Hand, etiquette. You know, there should have been an etiquette guide exactly. in the paperback here. You know.
But then the minute the editor speaks up, I'm like, uh-oh, this is a human being, a very intelligent human being who is not going to buy all my bullshit is actually going to question me now. And then I fall into super neurotic, you know, mode, and that always means like, okay, now not only am I going to think of this editor, now I'm going to think of all the other voices of dissent, all the people, you know, it goes from there, and so it just involves adding and adding and adding to appease all the various voices in my head.
So thinking about the audience then makes you more neurotic.
Over-anticipating often, yeah. I'm trying to tone that down right now.
Oh, that's interesting. I mean, but then to a certain degree, you have to leave things relatively organic and intuitive, and you can't think about an audience. It's important to have gestation here, and I'm curious if this might be possibly an issue. I mean,
I think it is. I'm a control
freak. You want
people
to like you, really, really like you?
Well, not even like me, but I like some control over how people are digesting my work. That's ridiculous, but I think it also has to do with communication, and because English wasn't my first language, I always feel like I often repeat, I'm like Joe Biden, I'm often like repeating the same thing over and over and over, and people are like, I got it the first time, you know, there's no need to say the same sentence over and over, but it's like, I always feel like people aren't hearing me or somehow don't understand what I'm saying. So, you know, I have to back off, I think, now. I'm learning that.
I've heard that Nicholson Baker, what he does is that he control F's a specific phrase throughout all of his work to make sure that he has not written that particular phrase before. Do you have this level of detail?
I do that with certain words, because I will have words that are like my favorite word of the moment. And I'll do that thing that I did when I was, you know, a young immigrant. I used to keep a list of vocab words that I loved. And even now there'll be some word every once in a while that I'll have on this little list by my desk. Like, I like that word. Let's use that word somewhere. But I
have
to really...
You have actually a list of words by your desk?
Yeah, sometimes I do that.
It's like the words I have to include in the book?
Yeah, really? And they're not like $10 words or, you know, $100 words, but they're just interesting or strange, you know, words or unusual usages. But I have to really... Then I have to... I'm very much tied to the find function and the replace function, so yeah. I'll have to double check and make sure I don't use that word several times. But it's usually on a word level there.
When does this list of words come to fruition? Is it as you write a book, you... Oh, that's a great word. I think I'll add that to my little list here.
Yeah, it's like... it's all, right now, it's like scraps of paper, but it's usually when I'm reading. A lot, if I'm in a big reading period, which isn't necessarily in a big writing period at all. So I'll think one day I'll use this word, maybe. I haven't done it as much these days, but I still will. Sometimes someone will say something and I'll be like, wow, what is that? You know, and I'll still feel like I did when I was a kid, like stumbling on the English language and being fascinated, you know.
Interesting. Well, I wanted to also ask you about the numerous bulleted lists within this book. I'm curious because they're both in letters and numbers, and they are specifically used in relation to getting inside the heads of both Darius and Xerxes. And likewise, you are also fond of deploying the equal signs in relation to character consciousness. I mean, for example, when Xerxes speculates about his father, you write, did broken frame equals nervousness equals illicit activity equals someone who had been inside equals a girl like that equals a girl like that who had kissed him. Now, I'm curious how this mathematical approach to consciousness came about, and I'm also wondering if there may in fact be a certain disadvantage towards thinking about the interior lives of these men and essentially detracting perhaps from the rather ambiguity of emotion.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I guess I think that's how most people think. I think that's how I think, to be honest. And I do think, you know, that's probably my attempt at trying to, my attempt at realism or hyper-realism in a way, trying to convey, you know, authentic thought patterns. It's sort of, I see now what you're saying. I mean, that certainly isn't how everybody thinks, and certainly not how these men would always necessarily think, but... it was sort of, I guess, attempt at sort of comical shorthand for their sort of immense, they're often reductive ways of dealing with huge problems.
Sure.
And these specific men, not men in general, you know. So, yeah, that's interesting. I wonder, And also, you know, I'm the child of a nuclear physicist, and I, as a child, I was obsessed with math and science. I don't know if that just explains, you know, equation, you know, those marks, but I do think a little bit like a math and science nerd, yeah. I think. So that's interesting. So
well, I bring this up in light of the fact that you also have two protracted scenes in this book that essentially depict the anxiety of waiting, and the scene with Darius freaking out when the subway stops, and also, I'm sorry, Xerxes, and the post office scenario with Bob. And both of these essentially take consciousness and split it up into conflict. There's a compartmentalization obviously going on that might actually speak to this math and science instinct that you have revealed here, but I would also argue that these particular sections are also more emotional because there aren't really a lot of these lists or these equal signs or, in, I guess, equational way of expressing emotion. And I'm wondering, maybe, are you just a person who's anxious about waiting? What happens?
Yeah, I think that for me, the post 9/11 era was a lot about anxiously waiting, actually. Mm-hmm. And so those scenes were probably the most from my actual experience. You know, they were almost like transcribed from almost like journal entries of that period, you know, being in those scary post office lines when they were all wearing those masks because of anthrax and, you know, and then there's a subway stalling around, you know, right in October of 2001 or November 2001. What could it mean? You know, what does it really mean? What are they not telling us? So maybe it's because those scenes were just rather than maybe those parts that I have to double check, but maybe those parts where I do those lists or the equations, maybe they're more imagined. And maybe the reason that those other scenes read more authentically to you is because they just were more authentic to me, maybe.
Well, I think authenticity is not what I'm specifically asking about. I think it's more of this idea of looking at feelings or thoughts in equations versus looking at feelings and thoughts through a more, I suppose, traditional way, or rather more, I guess, organic way. What of this? Does it just come, you're saying it's transcribed from a journal. I'm wondering if it's if this is what determines how you think about feelings.
Wow, that's interesting. This is a good question for my therapist.
I'm not saying it's wrong, I'm just asking.
Yeah, no, it probably, you know, like, for instance, let's say this. I tend to not like a lot of mainstream novels, and I particularly have problems with some of the multicultural canon. And I have trouble with them because there's nothing wrong with this. They're often in linear narrative, and there's a lot of very emotional scenes and often very moving moments. But the minute someone gives me some of those, I immediately distrust the work. And I think someone wants me to feel something. This is bad. I don't know why, but I mean, I don't think that's fair, really. But that's how I feel, nonetheless. And so, for me, sometimes, it is playing a game with emotions, or sometimes being contrary or reactionary, or a little bit roundabout in my own thinking and in conveying other characters' thinkings feels more real to a certain type of person. Again, I'm writing about characters that are fairly eccentric. I would probably say I'm fairly eccentric, so I understand how this wouldn't be, you know, most people in a way. But I don't know. Am I answering that? I kind of think that's what I think, is that it's a certain type of thinking that's helped me survive. And I don't know if so much of this novel, not a lot of this novel to me feels totally organic, you know. There are a lot of, I think, games played intentionally. And
so you're just as guilty as the mainstream novelists who you are imputing here.
Probably. Well, I don't think they're playing enough. They're playing a game that they would never say they're playing a game, I think. I think they're saying that, like, this is the plight of these people. Mm-hmm. And here is the beginning, the middle, and the end. And it's all it's tragic. It's a story you've heard before. You'll be moved by it because it's familiar, too. And it is tragic. And you will cry at this point. But I got so sick of that. I guess I was raised on that to such a degree that I often wanted to toy with that and be a little bit irreverent and sometimes immature about how I dealt with those moments. So I think that's it. For me, the real challenge of the novel was those sections where, you know, you do have Xerxes calling his parents on the morning of 9/11, you know, and he has to say that he's alive, you know. There was no being cheeky there, you know. And that was a little bit more challenging. I think probably at the heart of it, I'm more of a dark humorist or maybe even an absurdist. But so that's where I come from, I guess.
I'm just curious, though, going back to this aversion to mainstream narratives, about what you distrust specifically about it. I mean, is it the matter of reading a novel and being able to see the formula in plays?
Partially, but also that familiarity and that universality. Universality kind of freaks me out. Like, this is the narrative of these people. This is the narrative of all people. These are the human issues that we all deal with. And that sort of imposition for me feels eerie, a little bit authoritarian.
Huh. But a novelist is an authoritarian figure. You, in fact, I would argue with the bird near the end, you even remark there's one line where you say, like a god determining this particular thing, and you played God there. You were authoritarian, Porchista. So you can't you can't have it both ways here. I'm wondering if your aversion to the mainstream novel is perhaps a fear, or perhaps a concern, that would be a better word, that you will actually be understood by a considerable audience.
Again, I think that's probably a question for my therapist. I think, again, it has to do with, I mean, probably my background. And, you know, I didn't grow up in Tehrangelis, for instance. I was in a small suburb outside Los Angeles that virtually had no Iranians there. So, again, I always felt different. And, you know, then that just was encouraged by going to Sarah Lawrence undergrad. I'm trying to think. I mean, it's not that I despise all those novels or I despise all those narratives. It's just that I read about different types of characters and different types of scenario. I want there to be room for the immigrant narrative that's happy or silly or strange, rather than this formula that, again, like, just, you know, that does sell books, that people seem to want to read. But, you know, I generally never agree with the tastes of most people, you know. I don't know.
But, you know, David Foster Wallace, who I know you greatly admire,
yes,
who you've claimed is your hero, yeah, you wrote a little something for my website, and thank you very much.
Yeah,
it was very
thank
funny.
You. Yeah.
But here was a guy who was very distinct, but he did reach a mass audience. When Infinite Jest came out in 1996, everybody read it. It wasn't like Bolaño, where only the literary snobs are going to read 2666.
Yeah.
I mean, this was a book that everybody was reading. It was
Everybody read it, or did everybody buy it?
Everybody bought it, probably.
Yeah.
I mean, some people got through the end, some people didn't. But the point is it was just like Neal Stephenson, I would argue,
yeah,
too. Very much a big novelist that regular people read as well as literary people. And I'm you know, I have to go ahead and point out that this writer who you admire was in some sense universal.
Absolutely, yeah. I think that's why that's his amazing strength, and that's why, you know, he's my hero and not, you know, my peer, or even, I would never even call him a mentor of mine. I consider him too high above me. Yeah, that's the brilliant thing. I mean, I was just recently reading his New Yorker, his last, I think, New Yorker fiction, Good People, you know, and I was just thinking, God, I was telling my students how anyone could pick this up. And maybe it's probably not as strong as piece, but I still think it's incredibly moving. And almost anyone could appreciate this, and anyone could get through this. And it's, so he does have that amazing gift, you know. I think he actually had it a bit more through his, I don't know about Infinite Jest. I was actually shocked to see all the very literary, very arty people say that they hadn't read it after he passed away.
Yeah.
So I don't know if he... I feel like people thought that they could connect with him, but then even a lot of very literary and intellectual people were turned off by the experiments. So, you know, I wonder even with him to what degree that's true. I don't really understand what... I look at the book club picks, and I'm always sort of bewildered by what people do read and what they do like. sometimes it does surprise me. But sometimes I'm just a little bit disappointed because I don't think it's that difficult. I don't actually think it's that difficult. If you did give, you know, even brief interviews with Hideous Men or something a chance, you know, I don't think it would be that. I remember I gave it to my father.
Yeah.
And, you know, I always thought of my dad as just a real, like, you know, physics guy. He doesn't read a lot of books anymore, and he totally got it and appreciated it. And that's the view I take with my students, but I struggle with it still.
Huh. I mean, I'm wondering what... you know, what your concern is for possibly being universal. And we'll get back to the book, don't worry, but I am interested in this particular thread here.
I don't know if it's... I don't understand it in a way. I don't know what universal is. How can we... I don't buy into the sort of mushy, cozy, you know. We are all humans. We all have the same experience. We all love, we all die, you know. I just think that's a little cheap, and so I think that I'm interested in the nuances, and I'm also interested in the exceptions to every rule. So that's probably more my subject.
You need to revolt then, basically.
Probably. Like I said, it's maybe a little immature, but you know, I'm still in my young writer phase.
That's fine. You know, we'll get you 10 years from now, and then
yes,
we'll get really hard questions. But,
yeah.
I wanted to ask you about the ineffable moment, of course, that upsets Xerxes and causes him to essentially split up with his father. It's predicated upon abuse, and yet I think it can likewise be sufficiently argued that Xerxes is rather insensitive to Suzanne's various kindnesses, and I'm wondering if this is an idea of carrying on this cycle of abuse that we don't talk about, that there is something deep, ugly, and visceral underneath the seams of any particular trajectory. What of this?
Yeah, I think you got it exactly. I think it does have to do with the cycles of abuse, exactly. And I think Xerxes is always struggling with, you know, he realizes he's a lot like his father, but nothing scares him more than that. And so he's constantly having to, you know, struggle with that. Sometimes his own actions take over, and he's almost forced to confront them, but he never fully does.
Yeah.
And I think that's, you know, he's a difficult and sort of frustrating character for that reason. I guess I wanted that a little bit.
I also wanted to ask about the missing daughter, Shireen. This is intriguing because we then learn later, and I'm trying my best not to spoil anything, but there is a particular comparison made about the missing daughter. It's almost as if these two men have considerable difficulties with women. I also must point out the comparison that of Xerxes dealing with both Sam in his teenage years and Suzanne in his later years. And this makes me curious about how much this book was a pursuit on your part to really look at the way that essentially women relate to men, because that seems to be the common theme, even with the whole episode with Lala and Marvin.
Yeah, that was an interest of mine in a way. I mean, I came at the book originally thinking that this is going to be like a lot of the stories I've written, that it's really going to have a lot to do with middle-aged men. I've always been very interested middle-aged men, and so then I thought, then it became more of a father-son story, and then I thought, well, I can't exist in a vacuum, obviously there's women in this, and then I was the women kind of took a life of their own. The women, in a way, I felt like rescued these men in certain ways. They were sort of the secret saviors of the novel, in a sense, and I had a great affection for them in a way. They're also, I think, some of the most imagined characters. I mean, I never really knew a Sam. The mother is polar opposite of my own mother. You know, same with Suzanne. So they were interesting for me, and I like that to look at that whole tension between the men and the women in the novel, I think. Yeah.
Well, while we're on the subject of the family, I have to ask you about the names, Darius, Xerxes, Lala, of course. There is no particular effort in this book that I can see to bridge the Hell's Point, although it could be argued that the time period you pursue is perhaps a involves building a bridge to the 21st century or building a bridge even now. It's funny talking about it now as Obama's about to be president. there is this sense of that really might be the bridge. And Lala, of course, spends most of the time in La La Land. Yeah. But she has a friend in Gigi, and Marvin, who we mentioned earlier, is almost this like Maurice Chevalier type. So I would let you off the hook normally with a question like this about the origins of character names, but you are very careful to point out the little historical episodes about Darius and Xerxes. And so I am wondering why you needed these very explicit historical, cultural, and topographical associations for these names.
Well, on one level, they actually are very real Iranian names. You see Darius and Xerxes. And I met many after the book came out, so that's really interesting. Especially Xerxes, I think it's kind of strange, but people do name their kids that. So on one level, I wanted it to actually be real, and Iranians are always Americanizing their names in hideous, horrible ways. So Lala was felt real to me. But then in gathering material for the novel and trying to think about who these characters were, I kind of imagined a dad that was obsessed with Persian history the way my own father always was. And it wasn't like my dad was a historian. It was just, he just had the bits and pieces, the sort of artifacts of his culture that he could kind of constantly talk about to me and present to me as something we should be proud about, you know. Iranians are very prideful people. So, and they always have these little factoids about their culture that they'll, you know, whip out at any point. So I did this a very slight amount of research looking at some of the Herodotus that my father had always referenced. You know, I'd always been like, oh, Herodotus, yeah, he wrote about the Persians, but, you know, he did a horrible job. It's full of problems. And so I looked at that, and then I was interested in finding, I wanted the names Darius and Xerxes because they were father and son duo in a way that with a huge amount of obstacles. I mean, Xerxes was sort of the failed king. Darius was this glorious, amazing, you know, very loved king. He, you know, Persepolis was constructed under his direction. He was seen as a great lawmaker, great, very generous, glorious, but almost with an inflated, it's almost inflated when you read about it. And then Xerxes is kind of like, you know, how people talk about George W. Bush, you know, his own era was just fraught with all sorts of turmoil and conflict, so he didn't really get a chance to even be a good king, although he was, you know, arguably quite corrupt, too. So I liked them, these 5th century BC Persian kings, as being the sort of models, only slightly. There's not exact parallels to their life, but the Xerxes never quite fulfilled Darius in history, and that now I could have a Xerxes that was always struggling to fulfill Darius now in the early 2000s was interesting to me. So I played with the names there. You know, the other names, not as much. Suzanne I played with, because Suzanne is, if you say Suzanne in Farsi, it actually means like needle.
Yeah.
I just like that somehow. And because it was easy, and it wasn't like a character Americanizing the name, but Xerxes was doing the opposite in his head. You know, he was thinking, oh my God, Suzanne means this scary thing. And Shireen meant sweetness in Farsi, which I liked. And I don't know about the rest of the characters. Oh, Babak, the missing brother, you know.
Yeah.
You know, I liked that he could easily Americanize his name to Bob, you know, and he was kind of a guy whose face you never quite see, so that was a good name.
You only drop a handful of letters and it becomes Americanized. That's what's fascinating. Yeah. I mean, Lala is just the H, and Babak, it's just the AC. I mean, it's interesting that you have the names Americanized when they're not really that difficult to remember.
No, not at all. I mean, it's so crazy. The name Lala, I think any American, I just give it to, if they just read what's on the paper, they can say it. It's not hard. Even my name is like fairly easy if you just read what's there. But I think Iranians overreact to that. They think, uh-oh, here we are, and everyone will have a problem with me, so I'm going to over-anticipate, like I was saying about myself earlier, that they immediately feel that they have to fix it somehow to blend in. I think part of that has to do with Iranians often visually passing for so many different ethnicities in the States. So it's another attempt at, like, you know, assimilating, I guess.
However, the name truncation is not limited to Iranians. It's
That's
also
right.
Sam in this book, who is non-gender specific, which is interesting in light of the book's many concerns and many clashes between men and women. I'm curious again about Sam because she's like this steel-toed dock-wearing goth-like figure who, in the very beginning, who essentially wants to galvanize Xerxes.
I really liked the character of Sam too, and that was sort of fun for me to write her character. And the main purpose, I think, in writing Sam for me was to talk about how in the States, in that time period of, say, you know, the early to mid 80s to the early 90s, you know, it was a tough time, I think, for Iranians in the U.S., you know, post hostage crisis, of course, and so you were hearing a lot more derogatory language aimed at Iranians. But the kids who often embraced the Iranians were these kids on the fringe. So I remember, you know, all the kids who didn't exercise in PE class, or just hung out on the side. They were always very open to being my friend. Or all the goths, the punk rock kids, the skateboarders. They were often really open, and they liked my weirdness. And I was never able to fit in with, you know, the sunny soccer-playing blondes. So I've always been grateful to that sort of counterculture community. And so I wanted Sam to be there as an example of, you know,
someone who embraces.
The Americans that did really embrace the freakish Iranians of that period. So, because I didn't think there was a lot written about that ever. And I've always been interested in that. Like, I've been to Stockholm a lot in several summers, and I have relatives who live there, but still the Iranians really stand out, obviously, in Sweden. But it's funny, I would walk around the streets there and I'd always feel so out of place. But then the minute I'd go to some place where there were like goths on the street corner, or, you know, homeless gutter punks, those kids would just come right up to you. And they almost, you know, fetishize the whole Persian thing a bit. But, you know, they were really excited to meet people from the Middle East. And they had researched stuff about the Middle East. And so I've always found that kind of fascinating.
Well, I would agree with you that Sam certainly represents this undeniably American streak that has, I think, always been in American history. And yet, I have to contrast Sam with Suzanne. It's almost as if the notion of being interested in other cultures, in other people, in the misfits or the misunderstood, has transmuted into this kind of empathy that causes one to operate with one's blinders on as to the, you know, the selfish needs of, say, somebody else. Is this your suggestion that 9/11 transformed the impulse of looking at people with a rather open mind into this this scenario in which one can be exploited for doing the same, in which one can essentially not have the wisdom to look at someone who's being self-absorbed or solipsistic or whatnot? Or?
Absolutely. That I'm completely interested in. I think that was a big part of it. Also, the character of Suzanne was there to be... Suzanne is 3/8 Iranian.
Yeah.
And she is obsessed with Iranian culture as she knows it. You know, to her, that's all about, you know, embracing the media images that are out and about of Iran nowadays. You know, the women in the headscarf struggling, you know, the polluted metropolis in crisis, you know. And she's really trying to be this really avid, interested Iranian, you know, while she's in the States. She's really embracing that side of her culture, and she's sort of a self-hating trust fund kid from, you know, Westchester. But she's really trying to rediscover that, and that's, I think, a generational thing. I see that in a lot of Iranians who've been born in the U.S., I mean, like my brother's generation. My brother's 5 years younger, but that's a huge difference. He was born in the States, and for instance, the last thing I would have ever wanted to study in college was Near Eastern studies or any sort of Middle Eastern studies. That's what my brother does. He does comp lit, and he only studies Near Eastern studies. And he's so into embracing our culture in a way that I take for granted. And all I think about is how difficult it was, you know, being in here, you know, in the early 80s, and how hard it was for me to be Iranian. And he has a totally different view. It's never hard for him. And so Suzanne kind of talks to that in a way for me, if I had to pick my own characters whose responses I I feel closer to. I think Sam for me has a more genuine innocent response. Suzanne doesn't mean badly, and in the end I think she comes out quite well, but I think she grates on Xerxes' nerves all the time because she's saying, let's go to Iran, let's really be quite Iranian, let's eat Persian food, let's talk to your parents. And he's like, it's a lot more complicated than that. I have a complicated relationship to my homeland.
Yeah.
And she doesn't see that.
I'm curious, this goes back to what you were saying earlier about exposition being more difficult for you than dialogue. It's interesting that the book increased in size during the course of the editing in light of something I had observed, which was that we only have a general description physically of Xerxes to go on. Not only does Suzanne's family misconstrue X with Z, but Suzanne herself, who has been with this guy, can only describe him as tall, dark, and handsome. You know, from Iran, that's what she says. I'm wondering why you refrained from this physical detail. Was this a way of demonstrating that how characters were viewed through the prism of 9/11? I should also note that this relates to another concern that some critics, such as Judy Butnitz, has brought up, and that is the frustration of some readers at your tendency to abstract or omit particular details. If you had to write this novel again, would you have revealed more? Would you have been more specific about the physical description? What of this?
I don't know if I would. Probably in a different type of novel, maybe the one that I'd be working on next, I might do that. But, I think it goes back to the stuff I was writing before this. I was really interested in almost empty vessel, abstract, archetypal characters. I was writing a lot of parables for a long time, and I was really interested in the parable form, like the Kafka-like parable in a way. And I think, for instance, Kafka's parables are great ways to talk about ideas and themes, of course, and that's why he does a lot of that. And so these characters on some level started out, for me at least, as real symbols. And of course, the writing of the novel forced me to delve into the emotional and all that stuff, of course. But I didn't really want them to necessarily have faces and names. In a way, in my own head, they don't completely. And I would tell my students, that's a danger sign. You need to know your characters. You need to be able to describe them. And I have to say, I vary with Darius and Xerxes, I don't have a good answer to that.
But the faces did speak. That's interesting. Yeah, they spoke in italics.
I know. This is what I'm telling you about. My brain is strange like that. It's But I did see Lala, kind of. And I did see Suzanne. And I did see Sam. But Darius and Xerxes had this way of, I guess, representing such a huge set of issues. Maybe it's also related to the fact that Xerxes was me in a lot of ways, I know it's
a diffidence on your part to confront this dark truth?
Yeah, and I think people always think it's gauche when writers draw attention to their own biographies or stuff like that. But I don't, why not? Who cares? I do think that maybe his facelessness in a way had to do with he would have a very girly face. He would be me in a sense. And maybe in some ways Darius would be aspects of my father and my mother even. So that could explain it to a degree. I suppose I might put in a few more physical details,
But even keeping things from the reader in terms of what specifically has happened. The conversation that Suzanne and Xerxes has, that there's like this almost jump cut
in the
book. And it's like, well, wait a minute. Did I miss? I had to read that before part twice. Did I miss something here? No, I didn't. Okay, I see. So this has been conveniently dropped. Going back to this idea is there a certain unwillingness to go into certain areas for you as a writer?
Did you think the narrator was sort of voicey? I mean, the narrator was a little bit of a character in a way.
What's weird is that the characters kind of came through in these rather clause-heavy sentences that I really didn't even think of the narrator as a character, truthfully. I thought of it more as a sort of representative, I think it was more representative of consciousness, if anything.
Yeah.
So as a result, I didn't really view it as omniscient. I viewed it more as a sort of, with the italics,
and with the various, you know, I mean, basically we're jumping from one consciousness to another. And I had no problem with. But what was interesting is that just there were all these gaps, and I'm wondering if it was unwillingness, why that was.
I think it had to do with the narration for me being, in a way, I thought of it as very third person limited between. And constant tug of war between Xerxes' third person limited and Darius' third person. And sometimes point of view switches in the middle of a sentence, you know? And so somehow that tug of war, I felt like Xerxes, for instance, wouldn't want to overtly describe a scene of violence against Suzanne. He would skip that. He can't confront that. We have to confront that. In a way, that's me acting it out as I'm writing it. I can't talk about that part. I can talk about my father's bird burning. Because how dare my father have ever done that, you know? But I cannot describe to you that, what I do to Suzanne. I can talk to you about the aftermath. And so maybe that was all about me inhabiting their brains a little bit and wanting those sections to be quite, you know, allied with a particular point of view. I don't know. I think so.
Well, what's interesting is that you're happy to pursue neurotic avenues, clearly.
Yeah.
But avenues of real pain here, you either have them anticipatory through the bulleted lists, or you don't even broach them at all. And I'm saying that you've got some emotional truth in this book. Why not go all the way?
Well, the ending, I think we can't obviously talk about exactly, but I can say like the ending was one of the last. Well, I had many alternate endings, and one of the things my agent said right before we submitted it, she said, look, the ending's a real problem. It was an old ending where it was so like abstract. There was no answer. It was just like, and it ended, and it's total weirdness. And it left the reader with essentially really nothing after this long, exhausting journey. So she said, you've got to give the reader something more. The reader really has to take, and it has to be emotional, and you have to really let it come together at the end. And so I went back and forth on that ending so much, and I even called up friends of mine who had read it. You know, I was desperate. I felt like I'd given myself some fake deadline of like New Year's, you know. I was calling up people like, please tell me, what do you think after reading this? What would you want to see? Just tell me what you want.
And they came down like, to focus groups at the end.
Totally. And they're like, what are you talking about? No one would do this. What sort of writer are you? And I'm like, I don't know. I'm just bad at endings. I'm bad at this ending. I don't know how. This story will never end for me. So an ending feels artificial. So in the end, I talked it out with a friend, and I realized I just had to really make a decision about the ending, and I had to let the emotion bubble up to the surface, and in a way, I had to go against the contract of the first sentence of the novel in some ways and violate the whole contract of the book to get there. But so that was very hard for me to write, and it was an ending that was fairly emotional, or some of the 9/11 scenes for me were hard to write. So I think it's there, but I think you're right to point out that there's, you know, a lot of omissions and twists and turns. I also wanted to write a different type of Iranian novel. This is one of the first actual Iranian-American novels. I'm not one of the first Iranian-American novelists, but this is the first of that sort of hyphenated genre. I was calculated about this. I wanted it to be a different beast than what I felt like it was going to be. So it was important to me to have, you know, my interest in style and experiment and in play to be there. I wanted the novel, to be moving, I guess, but I also wanted it to be funny. It was really important for it to be funny at certain points.
One other thing I noticed that you dropped between hardcover and paperback is that the acknowledgments section has diminished. Names have been dropped.
You're a good reader.
This is extraordinarily suspicious. I mean, what happened here? Was it too much effusiveness in terms of the thanks? I mean, what happened?
Wow. So do writers, tell me this, do they not do that usually, the acknowledgement sections stay
the
same?
I've seen the acknowledgement sections normally expanded. Like carry over between the two editions, in your case it actually was reduced, and I'm like, a lot of people are going to pick up the paperback over the hardcover, and is that really fair to the people that you thanked here? I mean,
wow.
What happened? Names are gone.
I know. How to be diplomatic about this question. You're such a good reader. I just assumed no one looks at the acknowledgement section other than the people that think they're going to be acknowledged. I wanted it in some ways to be more vague because I felt like I'd omitted people who came up to me and said, oh, I can't believe you didn't mention me or something. It was so awkward. And so I thought if to keep it more vague somehow includes more people, it just is a general. But I know it looks bad because I actually took out so many names to do that. I have to tell you, you know, some relationships shifted after the novel came out, and so to take, I didn't want to take out one or two names.
Yeah.
So I felt like I had to take out more to, you know, underplay some of the bad drama. But I'll be really frank too. I've lost a lot of friends. After the book came out, or right as it was going to.
Because of the book.
Well, I hope it wasn't because of the book. It was probably just because of, like, what people thought would happen with the book. I don't know. I mean, I can't, and then really nothing changed at all. So, I mean, I just did readings more, and I did some interviews. That's it. But I think that some of that came into play. Yeah, it's sort of mysterious. I mean, I've gained a lot of... people that I'd say are associates or, you know, email buddy. I have so many email buddies, you know, but I've probably lost a lot of my old friends.
Yeah.
You know, some,
I guess, that's part of life.
Yeah,
but,
that's life. Yeah.
But how do you, maybe this is the subject of a novel, I suppose, or a story. Maybe this is the urgent thing you need to write before January 20th.
I know, exactly. It's interesting. I mean, yeah. I don't know how to. I almost wanted to section an anti-acknowledgement section, to write a whole section about all the people who've, like, fucked me over, and the people who I really want to say, like, you know, thanks a lot for nothing. I always wanted to write one of those.
Or you could go the other way. Like, did you see Jennifer A. Lee's acknowledgements for her Fortune of History of Chinese Food?
It
went on for, like, you know, pages upon pages.
Jeez.
It was like, I've never seen an acknowledgements page so detailed. She thanked every conceivable person.
Really?
Who maybe she even shook the hand of someone. And just, I mean, it was like literally hundreds upon hundreds of names.
My publishers probably wouldn't have allowed that. That's just too much. It costs too much. I also thought I was doing my publishers a favor because we had a reading group guide in there, and I thought that's going to take up more pages. So maybe cutting it down would be better.
Did you I know some authors actually do write the questions for the reading group. Did you do that?
They asked me to at first. They said, you know, do you want to just do it yourself? And I thought, oh, no way. Like, there's no way I could come up with that. I would be so bad at that. So I gave it to a friend of mine who was like a big comp lit kid at NYU, and I thought he did a good job, but I wouldn't know where to start. I think the reviewers and the critics of my novel are always smarter than I am about it. So
maybe it's not a matter of being smarter. It's a matter of your particular view of the novel was different from the reader's point of view of the novel.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, yeah. So I was fascinated. Yeah, Assad did a good job. But I don't know. I'm happy about the whole formatting of the paperback much more than the hard. I also like the new cover better. Yeah. And that was, I had to push that in a way. Grove doesn't like to do different covers, but I was happy. I was happy not to have the image of the World Trade Center, I think, on the cover the second time around. I think that comes from a very...
Not wanting to play the 9/11 card
yes,
so much.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And I've always been, you know, careful not to talk about that as a first... It's not the first and foremost issue of the novel, but I could see that someone would want to maybe market it that way. And that's just not fair to I don't think...
Well, we're moving into a new age where suddenly any kind of art that looked at 9/11 is possibly going to date in some sense, depending upon how explicitly they referenced it. Do you worry about, I suppose, people who might be looking at this novel after the Bush administration? Or?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. It's a really interesting topic. I think with my novel, it's not a major topic in it. It's the background of this event. Of course, that was strategic in a way, but it also had to do with my own timeline as a human being. You know, it was just a big event for me right out of college, and it was for Xerxes in some ways. I really wanted to capture the feeling of being an unemployed 20-something, you know, of color, you know, in New York at that time. So that was the main interest. Post 9/11 era was more interesting to me than the event. The event is barely described in the novel. So, yeah, it could be dated, but so many things about the novel, people forget the timeline. I mean, the novel came out when Ahmadinejad, exactly to the date of when he came to speak at Columbia, but there was no dialogue about Iran when I started writing the novel.
Yeah.
There was no feeling that Iran might be next.
Yeah.
So all the stuff about Iran in there is sort of, had nothing to do with 9/11.
Yeah.
But of course, when the novel actually came out, people were thinking like, oh my gosh, they were acting like I wrote the novel last week. And this was all about, you know, thinking that we might get attacked by, you know, the U.S. and all this stuff. And it was just, it was an artificial element in my novel that, you know, the Darius even had a moment of thinking, oh, people might be looking at me as a terrorist, you know. That had more to do with hostage crisis stuff. But yeah. I don't think after 9/11, I mean, people, yeah, they recognized my family and I as Middle Eastern, but I don't think anyone was thinking any of the hijackers were Iranian, or that's just not the Iranian way.
But what's interesting, too, is that you lucked out with a paperback because, of course, he sent a thank you note to Obama as well, and that's become a weird political issue as to how one responds.
Exactly.
You know?
Oh, it's that whole Iran issue was, I think, so awkward for Obama and everybody involved. I mean, I think this is my dad and I were talking about this. We suspected that the Iranian government is really pro-Obama, but they weren't saying that a lot before the election results. And I think they were saying that because they realized, you know, if Iran says we love Obama, then Americans will be like, see, this is why McCain should be there. But I think now they're maybe speaking out about it.
Well, he's trying to be diplomatic.
He's trying to be diplomatic. Yeah. But I think, I mean, what doesn't thrill them about Obama is that, of course, the whole pro-Israel stuff.
Yeah.
But it could have been a lot worse, of course. I think it's funny that Al-Qaeda has on some website or something, they were so pro-McCain because they thought that would destroy the American economy so rapidly. But in a way, of course, them endorsing McCain really means they secretly probably were pro-Obama. So it's all so complicated, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, poor Chista, thanks so much. It was a pleasure chatting with
you.
Thanks for taking the time.
Thanks so much.
Your inflammatory writ. Your text that word inside a light be lit. Our music deserving devotion. I'm swerving, cried, do I deserve?